Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Leo Laporte. Episode 63 for April 4th, 2009. Woobie! Floss Weekly is brought to you by the 2009 Google Summer of Code Project. Google has posted ideas for participating 2009 mentor organizations. Review the ideas and get involved in the open source community at code.google.com/SOC. And don't forget to tell them you heard about it on Floss Weekly. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show all about open source software, free, libre, and open source software. Your host today, Mr. Randall Schwartz, Perl programmer extraordinaire, Squeak expert, Seaside expert, author of many, many books. Have all your books been on Perl, Randall?
All the books to date have been on Perl. Actually, no. Depends on how you count that. All the books that have my name on the spine have been on Perl, but I actually have, sitting behind me in my office here, I have a whole shelf full of books that's probably about 8 to 10 feet long that are books that I wrote for other companies like Tektronix and Intel and Motorola. Oh,
like technical manual kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So I started my career from 78 to 82. I was pretty much full-time technical writing. And then I've done some technical writing on contract from time to time since then as well. So
that's cool.
Those are clearly not on Perl. Many of those before Perl even existed. So clearly back in the early days. For example, my first manual, I think, was the 8001 in-circuit emulator microprocessor lab for Tektronix. So you pull the original 6502 chip. This is how long ago it was. You were going to build a 6502 or 6800 box, you would pull the actual processor and replace it with this probe that would go in place. And then you would have this hardware that would single step the 6502 or 6800, but it was an in-circuit emulator, so it pretended to be the original chip. This is how they used to do it in the old days. They actually used the actual hardware to simulate the hardware, but under massive control. And so I wrote one of the operating manuals that would say, here's how you single step it, here's how you run the debugger, here's how you dump the code. And boy, I tell you, when we got symbolic debugging in like the third edition, it was really cool. We could actually dump out actual assembly code instead of 001A3F, and you have to go look it all up.
Oh,
so
man.
It was quite cool. I did that at age 16. It was my first project. I was a salaried employee at Tektronix at age 16. Way back in the early days. So I was writing technical manuals for on a salary real early in my career. I had just graduated from high school, and Tech hired me, and I was doing some cool work for them. So yeah, I've been writing for a long time. So
you didn't go to college and study computer science at any point?
No, I've never been to college at all. Actually, no, I take that back. I did a few non-matriculating math classes just because Tektronix was paying for them at the time. So I did some classes. And it's also funny because I have taught I taught graduate school as a what do they call it, adjunct professor, where because your stature in life you qualify.
Right, right.
So it's funny because everybody kept coming up to me going, Dr. Schwartz, and I said, if you only knew. If you only knew that I've never actually been to college.
However, I can operate on you for a fee.
And I could teach you. It's all pretty funny. So yeah, it was pretty good. So yes, that's a. I really enjoyed that period of my life, and it's actually one of the things I had trained to be a programmer coming up to that, and I had wanted to be a programmer coming out of the chute. So right out of high school, I was already doing contract programming, but that sort of trickled out, so I got this job as a writer. And I'm really glad I did, because being a writer, I was able to develop that side of my brain, the skills of writing. And once I discovered that writing and software engineering are really the same task, 90% of it's the same anyway. You still go to meetings. You still think about your structures. You still interact with other people. You still have schedules. It's only that last 10% into what medium do you express your art that changes. And once I realized the joke behind all that, that I'd spent all this time really wanting to get back into software and then spent 4 years as a writer, when I finally started doing software again, I went, oh, this is all the same stuff. I'm just, the only thing I'm doing is I'm moving lines of code around instead of writing text. And after that,
really?
I said, I don't,
so for you, programming is like writing almost.
It's very close because what it is, in English, you have a set of words that you have to arrange in particular sequences to transfer some idea from my brain to your brain somehow. And so you're recreating the idea that's in my brain. And programming is essentially the same thing. I have an idea in my head.
Yeah.
I have a limited vocabulary in which to express that. And it's both a science, you know, there's the grammar of how to write the sentences in this computer language, but there's also the art. And it's similar to what it is in writing, you know, English writing, whatever we call this, because it's a, and you can tell, obviously, I'm so fluent, but, you know,
stick with Pearl.
Words, order, important, think now. Okay.
Use colons or white space.
It's too indented, yes.
So we were scheduled on this show. We were scheduled to talk to the creator of the Woobie
project. And he's there. He's there now.
And now he's on the air. So we were actually been going back and forth about whether we should fill until he shows up, whether we should do something completely different. But I think if he's on the air, we should probably talk to Agostino Russo,
yes,
who is the author of Woobie. Do you want to set this up? Do you want to tell people what Woobie is, or should we let Agostino tell us? So I'll tell you what. Tell us about Woobie, and we'll get Agostino on the air. So what is Woobie?
Woobie is the Windows Ubuntu installer, W-U-B-I. And I may be mispronouncing it, so we'll have to ask him how to pronounce it. I've heard people say Wubby. I've heard people say
Woobie. No, it's Woobie.
Okay, well then.
Maybe Agostino
mispronounced it the last six or seven times.
If he mispronounces it, then it's Wubby.
But from what I can see, if you're running Windows and you instead want to run Ubuntu, you want to try it out, you can, of course, boot an Ubuntu live disk, but then the data goes away once you're done, you know, because there's no place to store the data. It's not you haven't actually installed Ubuntu anywhere. You're just running it off a live disk. So then you have to think, okay, well, now I really want to run Ubuntu sometimes and Windows sometimes. I don't really want to make the full switch yet. So you would then have to think about repartitioning, you know, because you got to get that extra partition so that Ubuntu can sit in it somewhere. And then you have to think about things like grub to choose between what gets loaded and what gets selected at boot time. What Woobie does is it solves the problem by taking a standard Ubuntu installation disk and installing it in such a way that it gets installed into a virtual disk that is just a file inside your Windows partition. So you would allocate an 8-gigabyte file, for example, and then it installs Ubuntu inside that and installs a special step during booting that allows you to choose Ubuntu, but pointing at that one file that's inside your Windows partition. The net effect is you could have a complete on-disk installation of Ubuntu without having to sacrifice a partition on your disk. It's a little slower because of that. This isn't like the way everybody should do it, but it's a great way, for example, for you to walk over to your neighbor's Windows computer, your mom's or your brother's Windows computer, and say, here, you really ought to have Ubuntu. I'm not going to destroy anything. I'm just going to steal 8 gig of your disk, and let me, you know, give me 20 minutes to do it, and it's all installed. And then when it boots up, they can choose Windows or Ubuntu, and nothing has gone away. And if you later want to migrate that over to an actual partition, you can actually do that as well. So once you're actually committed to it, you can actually do the partitioning and stuff. But yeah, it looks really great. So I'm really happy to be talking to Agostino today. This is great.
Well, we'll get him on the phone in just a little bit and ask him about Woobie, which I agree with you is, you know, Ubuntu did a couple of things really right. Actually, you should give Nopix the first credit because they created the first live CD Linux that I was aware of anyway, that you could try Linux without installing it. And now this is the next step, which is you can install it without getting rid of Windows, without partitioning it. I mean, it's really important in the process of getting people using Linux to make it very easy for them to do so. Randall, the time has come for you and me to talk of many things, of cabbages, of sealing wax, of cabbages and kings. No, there's something missing there. Oh, I know what it is. The Google Summer of Code.
Yes.
The Summer of Code is coming. Actually, it's too late. April 3rd was the deadline for students to apply. But now's the time for mentoring organizations who want to do this next year to start thinking about it. And if you want to kind of take a look at what's involved for a mentoring organization. This is such a prestigious thing to participate in, and it's just it's the right thing to do. It's helping kids in college learn about open source, get an idea of what open source can mean, have some real experience participating in development for open source. Just give them, you know, real world opportunities to find out what computer science really is all about. We kind of call it flipping bits, not burgers, for the summer. And if you are a qualifying group, you should really here's the first thing to do. Go to SOCGHOP. What is that? Summer of Code, Google. I don't know what HOP would stand for.
No, really. I don't either.
Has open projects. I don't know. .appspot.com. SOCGHOP.appspot.com. You'll see the list of mentors from this year. You can be a mentor next year if you're a group running an active, free, or open source software project. The project does not have to be legally incorporated. You just have to produce and release software under the Open Source Initiative approved license, any one of them. You know, that's all the standard licenses. But if you want to visit the Open Source Initiative, you can see their list of licenses in order to participate. Mm-hmm. Be a mentor organization. Support the Google Summer of Code. We support it. We know you'll want to. And I'm really looking forward to this year's Summer of Code to see what projects the kids are working on. Kids have gone on from this to really great careers in computer science. And the mentor organizations all report just a wonderful experience. I mean, it really is exciting. In fact,
many of the organizations that we've had on Floss Weekly have been part of the Google Summer of Code, like Git and Perl and things like that.
Probably almost all of them, I would think.
Getting close, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it'll say on the website. SOCGHOP.appspot.com. It's driving me crazy. What, you know?
Maybe it's encrypted.
Yeah, it's a hash. GSOC is a Google Summer of Code, but that's not the URL. I don't know why they didn't make it gsoc.appspot.com. It doesn't say. It just is. SOCGHOP.appspot.com.
Mm-hmm.
Good. So let's get Agostino on the line. What do you say?
Indeed. Let's do that.
Hello, Agostino.
Agostino, Leo Laporte, Randall, what's your last name? Schwartz. From Floss Weekly. Hi, Agostino.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, we're great. Thanks for joining us on Floss Weekly to talk about, is it now?
Thank you very much.
You could solve this, their first debate, Wubby or Wubby?
I call it Wubby.
Oh,
I'm not sure myself, so whatever you prefer, really.
Well, we weren't sure, but I kind of thought it was Wubby, and so we're going to call it Wubby, too.
Sure.
Okay, good.
Can you send us video, or do you have a camera there?
Unfortunately, my previous machine abandoned me last couple of days ago.
Oh, no.
I just am using another laptop, and I tried to buy a camera, but that's it. I didn't manage to make it work in time. So
don't worry. Well, just imagine how handsome you are.
You have no idea.
Where are you located, Agostino?
I'm in London.
London, that's great.
Yes.
So how did Wubby get started? We talked a little bit about what it is. Many of us have used it. I mean, it's a really, really major step forward in making Ubuntu and Linux in general more accessible to Windows users. How did the idea come about?
I started basically as a standard normal user, like many people probably listening to this broadcast. And I was a Debian user to begin with. And a few friends were asking me about suggestions on Linux, which Linux version to use. And that was probably 2003, 2004. And at the time, I really enjoyed using Debian. It was very good for me, but it was that type of distribution that I never felt comfortable about suggesting to new users. So I started investigating alternatives, something I could confidently suggest to people to use. And because I liked a lot the way Debian worked, particularly on the package manager system, I started investigating distribution which were derivatives of Debian, and this is how basically I tried Ubuntu. When I first, I had to decide what to use. In fact, I remember at the time Ubuntu wasn't that popular. It was really the very beginning. And just had to choose what to try, whether MAPIS was another popular one at the time, or Ubuntu. And I went to Ubuntu mostly because of the philosophy. So I really liked what I saw, and you know, I became involved with the community more and more, and so I started helping users. And while I was doing that, I was noticing certain patterns. So I was noticing that people had far more issues with burning ISO that, than I was expecting. So, you know, a lot of people were taking the ISO instead of burning it. They were just copying it onto a CD, which is a different operation. They were sometimes using high speed for burning, so the copy wouldn't be correct. They never would run a checksum to double check their operation. Sometimes the medium wasn't quite appropriate. And sometimes, you know, even when they managed to do that, they would reboot the machine and the BIOS would try to boot from the first hard disk. And therefore, you know, all this work will be for nothing. You had, you know, I think everybody who has tried to convince some friend to go and try Linux has run into some situation like that. And I noticed there were a lot of cases. And at the same time, you know, I had some problem convincing friends to migrate just because their machine came with a single partition, as I guess is common for most users that buy a standard desktop off the shelf. And the partition, of course, as we know, is dedicated to the main OS, which is pre-installed in most cases. And a lot of users are scared about changing that setup. They don't want to modify their partitions. And it's fairly understandable, particularly if you are, you know, haven't made your mind yet about trying Ubuntu and you want just, or Linux in general, so you don't really know what it is you want to try, so why should I change my partitions just to try it? And, of course, then there, at the time there used to be the live CD, but as mentioned, you know, it was less than intuitive for, from, you know, my point of view, for a lot of people. And even when people managed to burn a CD and use it, a lot of times they were under-impressed by the performance. And it's, then you have to explain, yes, but this is running off the CD, therefore it's not as fast as a real installation. And yes, you can actually save files when you install for real. So there were all these caveats. And then you have to explain, yes, but the hardware is not necessarily fully optimized yet. So when you install, things will probably work even better, etc., etc. So I was investigating other ways of doing things. Never felt that, you know, presenting a user with ISO as a first approach was reasonable, particularly because many users are coming from a Windows world and they are not really used to ISOs or in general. So, you know, you present this file, they don't even know what it is in most cases. So what they are used to is executables. And at the time, there were other approaches. So I started investigating. There was two approaches which I liked a lot. One was Instlux, which basically is an installer based on NCs. But then all it does, it downloads an ISO. Then you have to install still the partition in your drive. So it installs from Windows, get the ISO, and then lets you reboot into that image, which then will have to modify your partitions anyway. So it solves half of the problem about taking care of the ISO. And then there was Topology Linux. Topology Linux basically is a distribution that can be installed inside of a file as opposed to being installed to a dedicated partition. And of course, as you can see, that solves the other half of the problem, except that they didn't come with a very friendly installer. So the idea was natural to me, is that, you know, we can take an installer similar to Instlux on this, the Windows side as a front end, and then do create a distribution which is similar to Topology Linux in terms of installation. So it gets into a file and not into a partition. Therefore, we don't need to modify the partitions to begin with, and we can even uninstall it. So I started looking how to do that. At the time, as it happens, technologies which were required to implement that were maturing. So, for instance, to do that, you need the first thing to have write access from Linux to the target partition. So even if you have to write into this file, so you need to have write access. And at the time, the NTFS driver only supported read access. So you weren't able to write, really. And there was a new driver coming up, which was NTFS 3G, which also allowed you to write to a file in NTFS from Linux. And I did need that capability. And as it happens, that file, that driver was becoming released as release candidate more or less in that period. At the same time, Group4DOS, which is a bootloader that can be launched inside of a Windows file system, which is something I also need for building this setup, was also maturing. So it was in a fairly reliable state. So I decided to give it a go, and I created a blueprint. There was, in fact, another developer who, based on his blueprint, implemented the first prototype. The first prototype basically was just booting a pre-made image, so which was inside of a file. And it was very well received at the time by the community, the Ubuntu community in particular. It was in a forum. After that, I decided to... I became more involved, and instead of using a pre-made image of a Linux distribution, which had all sorts of issues, it wasn't optimized for the hardware, it had limited sizes. So I decided to take a route which was closer to a real installation. So instead of having a pre-made image, I modified the installer, the Debian installer at the time, so that it could target a file as opposed to targeting a partition. And of course, I made necessary adjustments so that it could also boot from a file as opposed to booting from a partition. So there were a few changes to be done on the Linux side on top of the standard initramfs and sysv init script.
That's really amazing. It just sounded like there's like I'm hearing the story of like a whole lot of parts coming together. Like there was you needed like this piece and that piece and everything else. And I'm just wondering, it must have been fun to be able to take all those pieces and bring them together because you had the source code to all those pieces. And this is one of the things we keep coming across with open source. Is that something that you were aware of and happy that you were able to build on other people's work?
No, absolutely. This is exactly why open source is so great and why you can innovate so fast. Because you can rely on other people's work, modify if needed, and build upon it. And if you take in this context, for instance, take Vubi, it's not really that much code. It reuses other software. So there is much more work which went into NTFS 3G or Group4DOS. And so, you know, we just literally stand on the shoulders of giants. And Vubi is just one of the many tips of the iceberg. There is a huge foundation behind it. And of course, all this is possible because of the open source model. So I strongly believe that for software development and also in other fields, open source really makes things happen faster and it brings innovation quicker.
So let me see if I understand this now. So Wubi is an installer that knows how to take a standard Ubuntu ISO and then create a what looks like to Windows just a single file within the file system and install the Ubuntu inside that space. And then also install something so that when you boot, you can select to boot Ubuntu rather than Windows. And if you boot Ubuntu, it has to then... I don't know what, tell Ubuntu that here's your partition, it's in this giant NT file or something like that? Is that the parts?
It's perfectly correct. So basically there is two pieces, well, there are three pieces. There is the Windows side, which is the wizard everybody sees, is familiar with. And what that does, it first gathers information about the system. Mm-hmm. And that's, in fact, a fairly nifty feature because normal installers don't know much about the running system. In our case, we start with a running OS, and therefore there are a lot of questions that I can skip because I can see what's in use already. Mm-hmm. So the first role is we gather the information. This information is packaged into a configuration file called a precede file, which is then used in the real installation. So people think that installation happens in Windows. In fact, what happens is just information in Windows only we gather information. and mm-hmm. present this information to the Linux side. So this is all information is basically coded into a file, which can be read by an installer after you reboot. So the second stage is we create this file, and then we add a second bootloader. So we don't touch the Windows bootloader in any way. So we don't touch the MBR, we don't modify the bootloader. We simply add a second bootloader, which is just a file. And modify the options, the menu, the boot menu options of Windows. So we add a second menu option without modifying the bootloader itself. It's just a new option when you reboot the machine. And this points to this second bootloader, which we also install. And the second bootloader, in turn, will load up the kernel and initrd, which is the components required to start up Linux. And the initrd is modified so that it knows that it has to use a file, which is instead of a partition. And it knows that it has to read the configuration file we prepared previously. And this basically starts the real installer on the Linux side once you reboot, which runs in unattended mode because it reads the information from the precede file we generated in Windows.
So at no time, are you running Windows and Ubuntu at the same time? You're really either running Windows or you've rebooted into Ubuntu. This isn't something like Xen or VMware, right?
Yes, exactly. So basically the installation is exactly like a real dual boot. Some people have some, you know, think of it as a VM. In fact, you either run Ubuntu or you run Windows after this process. So you have to reboot the machine exactly like you will do in a real installation from CD. And exactly like in a real installation from CD, you will have a boot menu where you can choose whether to boot into Windows or into Ubuntu, except that in a real installation, the menu will be provided by the Windows bootloader. In Vubi case, by the Linux bootloader. In Vubi case, the menu is provided by Windows. So because we don't replace that, we leave the Windows bootloader, you will see the usual Windows bootloader with the menu options. And once you boot, and it's basically then it's Linux running. There is no Windows code running whatsoever. So the only thing we need from Windows is the file system. Or to say it differently, basically, you could delete C Windows, which is the folder where most people have the Windows operating system installed in, and you could still be able to boot into Ubuntu.
Wow.
This shows that basically there's no dependencies on Windows whatsoever, other what than kind the of bootloader system.
What kind of a performance hit are you taking because of that? Does this have to go through some complex translations then from like a virtual block number in the Linux side compared to the actual block in the NTFS side, or is that fairly simple math? Or I mean, how much of a hit do you think you're taking?
Basically, there is no hit for any type of hardware access. The only penalty is in terms of disk input output performance, which could be comparable, slightly faster than what you will get in a VM in terms of input-output for disk access. All the other access is native, so it's as fast as a real installation. So memory access, CPU, video card, sound card, is like a real installation. So for instance, you have a 3D FX, you can play video games, you can have a Compiz, a 3D desktop, everything you will normally have in a real installation.
But you might not want to use this for like a media server then, because you'd be pulling the disk pretty heavy for something like that.
Exactly. So if you basically plan to use it for media access, media manipulation, video editing, or for a file server, yes, of course, Vubi is not the right access because the right tool. But in this case, you might reasonably want to do a dedicated installation anyway.
Now, is there a transition path from this kind of an installation to, say, finally coming out and creating a partition and then moving my data over?
Yeah, in fact, basically, technically, it's fairly straightforward to do. After an installation, the files which are actually installed are identical to the files you will get from an installation from CD. So if you do a diff between an installation via Vubi and an installation via CD, you will find that the files are exactly the same. And of course, the bootloader configuration will be slightly different. But other than that, it's mostly it's exactly the same installation. So you could literally create a partition, dump the files, modify the bootloader and the file that configures, of course, the partitions, the access to the, how the mount points are loaded, and you're up and running. So we are planning to create it, such a tool so that when you you have a Vubi installation, you can have a second stage whereby you decide, I want now to move this installation to a dedicated partition because I've used it for long enough. I think it's something I want to have. So I can take the step of modifying my partitions and using this OS in a long term. And this tool will basically take modify the partitions and then migrate the current installation as a whole into the new partition.
Is that something that's going to be done with Windows booted or with Linux booted?
We plan to do that via the CD. So there are the obstacle at the moment is that because Linux is mounted when you are in Vubi.
Yeah.
So you know if you are you do it from within Linux, Linux is already the partition containing Vubi is already mounted, and online resizers don't really work that well at the moment. So basically, this would you will have to resize the partition which is mounted in most cases, and of course there are technical difficulties in doing so, mostly most kernel level. So what you really have to do is boot from a CD or a USB device, and then we'll make the installer recognize that you already have a Vubi installation in, and offer you the option to migrate that. In this case, of course, the partition is not actually mounted, so it's impossible for us to resize. So technically, we'll have to do it via the CD.
If I went into Windows and I duplicated this partition file, could I then select which of two installations to boot from the menu?
You could. You'll have to modify the boot menu manually, though. And that's basically because technically I don't really support that out of the box. So it's certainly possible. So if you just copy one, it's called root disk file, and you create a second root disk file called root disk 2 and create a second boot entry that points to that, certainly will work. And some people have done it. There is no reason to standardize that because today, it's at least in the Ubuntu world, you can install different desktop packages. So if you want to try Ubuntu and KDE, all you have to do is install one of the two, whatever you want to install first, and then you install the second package, which will actually take install the desktop with all the dependent files. And it will make you, you know, when you log in, you will be able to choose whether you want to boot to log in into a desktop, into a GNOME desktop environment or into a KDE desktop environment. And that's preferable than actually creating two completely new root partitions.
Well, I was thinking of something like maybe you're about to upgrade to the next release of Ubuntu and you don't know if that's going to be successful or not. So I could just use the Windows tools to duplicate this large file and go ahead and boot it without changing the boot menu, which still boot me into my old version of it. And then if something went wrong, I could just copy that other file back again, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So you don't even need any special tool. It's just one file. It's called root.disk. So you just copy that somewhere else. You can call root.disk.backup, and then basically you can install a new version. So once you replace that, then it will work.
So it sounds like a great level of safety for people who are first looking at Ubuntu and are already running Windows somewhere as sort of a slow transition. Now, clearly, you're going to either be in the Windows world or in the Ubuntu world as you're booting up your box. This isn't like VMware or Xen or something where we can have access to both at the same time. Although I imagine now that there are Ubuntu drivers that will give me access to the rest of my Windows disk, so I could still use, say, OpenOffice to look at Excel files and things, right?
Yes, correct. And in fact, by default, you have access already to all the files in the Windows partition, and which is normally mounted as host, so anything in there will be accessible. And of course, then nowadays the applications available in Linux allow you to open and edit most files which in the Windows world. So you can easily edit a doc file, an Excel a spreadsheet, a PowerPoint presentation. Almost anything today can really be manipulated from within Linux. And if you want and you need to, you can even install Windows application inside of Ubuntu. So that's also a possibility for people that might want to do so.
You mean they can take a standard Windows installation disk and pop it in and Linux knows what to do with it?
It's not that simple, but basically there is a compatibility layer called Wine.
Oh, yes.
Which makes it possible to run and install a Windows application inside of Linux. So some applications work at this stage better than others. So in some cases, it's really straightforward. It's as simple almost as putting in the Windows installation disk and installing inside of Ubuntu. Of course, you need to install Wine first. In some cases, the things are not really well supported. So, you know, your mileage may vary, as they say.
Exactly.
A third option, of course, if you really are attached to some Windows program you cannot avoid, you can install Windows Start VM inside of Ubuntu. That's also a possibility. Some people do that too.
That would be spooky. So you're inside an NT file running Linux, but running like a VMware or some other application inside that, looking back at the Windows partition.
Yes.
Ah, my head hurts. Ow.
Yeah, I know. But the idea is basically Wubi should be taken only as an introduction to Linux.
Sure.
So it's a medium-term demo. So it's a demo without much constraints at all. It's simply that when you move to a dedicated partition, you have slightly better file system access. It's faster and more robust. So it's more robust, particularly to hard shutdowns, which is an event which might trigger some problems in Wubi. And therefore, you know, in the long term, if you like what you see, you really might want to consider a dedicated partition. And from what I've seen for the current user base, a lot of people tend to use Wubi for one release cycle, which in the Ubuntu world takes 6 months. And then they normally upgrade when the new Ubuntu release comes about. So they won't, you know, once they have the new Ubuntu release, they say, okay, now it's time to install it for good. And that's a typical pattern.
Now, how much did you said you had to change Linux just a little bit, if I recall from earlier in the conversation. What did you have to change?
Well, basically, there are some subtle things which you normally don't think about because that are linked. A lot of them are linked to the fact that NTFS 3G driver is a user space driver, not a kernel module. So there are some issues. For instance, in a normal shutdown sequence, you reach a stage where a signal is sent to all user space processes to terminate so that the shutdown can proceed. Of course, if that happens and fuse is killed, and therefore NTFS 3G, that's the equivalent of ripping off your hard disk in our case, and which is not too good. So you have to modify the shutdown procedure so it doesn't kill the NTFS process. So this is some catch, and there are lots of gotchas like that when you boot, when you mount the partition and boot, installation, etc., etc. So it's very little tweaks that make it possible to boot smoothly and reboot smoothly from a file, which is something many distributions are not normally designed to do.
Okay, so
it's a series of patches. It's not like a massive body of work, but it's patches to modify the distribution so that they can tolerate that type of installation.
So these patches have been made to Ubuntu, also to Kubuntu, and maybe some other distributions too?
Yeah, basically all Ubuntu distributions share the same code base when it comes to the main installation files. So they only differ for the desktop and the application they install. But when it comes to core files, they all have the same files. So yes, this series of patches has been done to the core files now. So basically any distribution derived from Ubuntu is now capable of booting smoothly from a loop file, from a file instead of a partition. Interesting enough, yes.
No, I was just going to say that's as of what, 8.10?
Sorry?
As of 8.10 release?
Yes, exactly. Okay. That was, yes, the patches were merged between 8.04 and 8.10. So the first official release was, in fact, sorry, before 7.10 and 8.04. So 8.04 was the first official release for Vubi. And before that, Vubi was an unofficial project. So it was born as an independent effort of myself and a couple of other developers. Interesting, I was mentioning, at the time, I couldn't merge the patches directly in Ubuntu. So I had to use some workarounds and modify things at runtime. So it was a more daring approach. When we were basically accepted as an official installer, as they basically called me in and asked if we wanted to have this in the CD. Of course, I was incredibly happy about that. And it also offered the possibility of making all these changes, moving all these changes directly upstream. And I was helped by some of the best developers in Ubuntu. So it was a very good experience.
So what do I have to get if I've got a Windows box at home, which actually I don't, but if I do have a Windows box at home, I would have to download like the 8.10 ISO for Ubuntu, and I'd also have to download something else from your website, Vubi installer?
No, in fact, you only need Vubi, because if you download Vubi.exe, that includes a download manager, so that will also take care of downloading the correct ISO for you.
Okay.
And therefore, you don't really need to download the ISO. You can download the ISO separately if you want, and you can put the ISO in the same folder as Vubi.exe, and that will take care of basically using that ISO.
Well, one way or the other, you're going to have to download the ISO. I mean, whether Vubi does it or whether you do it, it's still going to take 670 megabytes of download to make this thing work, right?
Yes, correct. So either you let Vubi do it, which is a preferred option for some users, so they don't even have to worry about mirrors and things like that. Otherwise, you know, if you have your own download managers, you want to use BitTorrent, whatnot, then of course, yes, you can use your ISO and download the ISO and use that.
So you don't have like a BitTorrent client built into Vubi then?
And we have in the new development version.
Yes.
And it will be available in 9.04.
So 9.04. Oh, that's very cool. I was just joking.
Yes. No. We do. We had originally. So now we had some problems with some users not feeling comfortable with BitTorrent or having some firewall issues. So basically, we moved to a full HTTP downloader. And now we brought back BitTorrent. So we have both now HTTP and BitTorrent downloader built in.
Oh, that's
so
way
default,
cool.
It will default to BitTorrent. And if it fails, it will try to use HTTP.
Are you using a libcurl by any chance?
Sorry, Perl?
Are you using libcurl?
Perl, the language?
No, libcurl, curl to do the downloading from HTTP.
Very interestingly, the first downloader we had, basically, I've rewritten Vubi in Python recently, but before that, we were using NCs, which was something on the Windows side, and C++ libraries. And for the download manager, yes, we were using libcurl and something called Metalink, which is basically a new way of a way of encoding different sources for the same file. It's very nice, neat feature. So we use Metalink a lot internally.
What version of Windows? How far back and how far forward?
I think from Windows 98 to Vista, and probably even Windows 7 might work. We have now people testing that. Seems okay.
I don't know. You confirmed that it works on the beta then. Somebody has worked it on a beta already, the beta 7.
Yes, basically we have people that have been testing the new release of Vubi 9.04 on the beta.
And what kind of footprint does it require on your disk? How big of a, I mean, are we talking 4 gig, 8 gig, 20 gig? What kind of space is this going to consume from my existing Windows partition?
Vubi itself is very small, so it's 1 megabyte. That's not really much. You have, of course, to take into account, I have to download the ISO, the ISO file, that's 700 megabyte. And then all the rest is this virtual disk file. In fact, files, there are more than one. There's the swap virtual disk and the main virtual disk. So that depends how much space you want to allocate. Normally, I don't allow people to install anything less than 4 gigabyte.
Okay.
A barebone installation will take basically 2.5 gigabyte, but you want to have some headroom for to install further applications and to have some extra files. And the maximum I normally allow is 30 gigabyte. The idea is if you need more than 30 gigabyte, then you probably want to consider installing to a dedicated partition. But it will be more than enough for most people.
Is that a, is it fully allocated when you first do the installation, or does it grow as needed from the Linux side?
Yeah, this is a request. At the moment, we decided to use just as a pre-allocated file. It's more efficient. This minimizes basically the input-output impact. So I haven't found so far a fast enough expandable container, which can be used at boot time. It might be one of the future innovations that will bring about. In fact, in the future, it might even possible, assuming that NTFS 3G can support full POSIX semantic to install on a directory inside of Windows. Who knows?
And who's on the Wubi team? You created it originally, but are you working day by day with other people to make this better?
I basically, originally it was Jessa Kovacs who did the first prototype. I was working mostly on the Linux side, and there was another guy, Oliver Matos, who created the first Windows interface in NSYS. Then Oliver left, so I took care also of the Windows side. And I redesigned the interface, which is what people see today. I wanted to have basically a one-click installer. The first interface was like a traditional wizard with several pages. And I always liked the idea of I want to have the installer, which is one button, and that's it. Because I want to make Linux appear to be easy. I mean, it is far easier than it used to be, but people still have this preconception of Linux being difficult. And I don't think that's the case. So I wanted to redesign the interface to reflect that. I want to make an installer, which is one-click button, and that's it. And so I took care of the Windows side. And then when we migrated, when basically we were incorporated inside of Ubuntu, I received help from two Ubuntu developers. One is Colin Watson, who rewrote a big part of the installer. The installation side on the Linux side, and Evan D'Andrea, who also helped a lot when I had to do patches on the main Ubuntu distribution. I didn't have access to the file directly, so basically every patch I submitted had to go through Evan most of the time. So it was very helpful also to help me out on fixing different issues on the Linux side.
So do you communicate with mailing lists and IRC channels then as you're thinking about different issues
Mostly IRC, and then Vubi is in Launchpad, which is basically a project management website. It includes the source code, bug reporting, bug tracking, and so that is also used to as a centralized resource and communication management system. So it's a way in practice to communicate with each other. But mostly when we have to talk, it's IRC.
Has it mostly been bug fixing or feature enhancing? It sounds like you've been pretty much on the right track all along, but I imagine there were a few bugs here and there.
Well, and the bugs were very annoying at the beginning, but mostly because it was, in some cases, very difficult to debug. This is not like an application. An application, it crashes, but normally the condition in which it's run is fairly much predictable or to a certain degree. And it's relatively easy to get some logs, and you can analyze those logs and have a good picture. In fact, in Ubuntu, you have by default an application which traps other application crashing and generates a log, and so the developer can look at it and fairly quickly understand what went wrong. When you deal with an OS installer, it's much more tricky because you really have to deal with what hardware configuration people have. And a lot of the time when you have a problem, what happens is that you don't boot at all. And the thing is not even installed. So there are many cases, there are no logs to look at. And people simply reboot into a shell, which has fairly limited functionality. Mm-hmm. So it's either group shell or you will be in the BusyBox shell, either of which is not very user-friendly, to say the least. And because a lot of our users are, in fact, first-timers, which is something I'm quite proud of, but the downside of that is that, of course, they are not... it's far too difficult for them to help out when they run into those situations. And, of course, at the beginning, when things weren't that smooth, this is something that will happen with certain frequency in the beta stage particularly. So it was a bit challenging for myself and for the user as well to go through the try to extract useful information so they could understand what the problem was. I ran into strange situations. Sometimes there was a bug, I remember, where it would be triggered only when you had more than 10 partitions. So I didn't have that in my testing environment, and it it took a while to understand the problem because... And the user was was very helpful. They really try to help you out, but sometimes the situation is just a bit uncomfortable for them.
Yeah, and I'm mentioning that. So you have quite a bit of... Obviously, these are new users. What do you know, everybody that was... you know, pretty familiar with Ubuntu and familiar, you know, and you know, existing Windows users would probably use this. This is probably just for transition people. How has the acceptance been for this? Have you finding that people are able to share the new Ubuntu with their friends and coworkers using Wubi in a useful way?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, it has been used a lot as... a tool to test Ubuntu, to try Ubuntu, and to make your friend try Ubuntu. And it's designed to encourage people to give Ubuntu a spin without much concerns, because we don't touch the partitions, we do not mess around with the MBR, with your bootloader, so everything is as is. And if you like it, fine. If you don't like it, you can uninstall it, and you go back exactly as you were before you installed it, and that's the idea. So people can try Ubuntu, and they can try it for real. So it's not like a VM where a 3D acceleration doesn't work, and you have other limitations. It's not like a CD where you cannot save the files. This work like a real installation. So people using it really have a very, very good feeling about what Linux is about. So the reception has been good so far, from what I can tell. Of course, there have been people with issues, and we have millions of downloads, so there's always somebody who is less than happy, but most of the feedback has been positive from what I can gather.
Wow. I was just talking with Colleen, who's our studio manager here. Who knows of Agostino because she frequents the Wubi forums, and she says, you are great, Ago. She says, you know, people ask questions. You're really helpful. You're really involved. And a lot, it's not always the case. A lot of times a guy who puts together a project like this is not as available as you. So she wanted me to thank you specifically for being...
Thank you very much.
Really.
No, but I must say that basically for me, there is also a reason for that. Because, as mentioned, a lot of users were first-time users. Those users are not really accustomed to bug reporting tools. And a lot of
you're not going to get them to use Bugzilla or anything. I mean, that's...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so yeah. Basically, a lot of the bugs I will get through only via the forum. So a forum was, for me, a very good way to first get feedback and... Second, get early signs of problems. So I was really in the forum trying to filter out people, helping people, and understanding what the problems is, what their feature were. And in fact, you know, Vubi was born in the forum, and it was born from the community. So for me, the forum is like home, really.
That's really great. Yeah.
Do you have any sense of how many downloads you've had?
It's difficult to say because Vubi is now basically hosted on the main Ubuntu site, and I don't have statistics for that. But I will guess easily above 3-4 million.
Wow.
Wow.
Very cool.
That's really great. Yeah, you've done a lot, I think, to promote the use of Ubuntu and Linux in general with Vubi. It really makes it easy to do.
I mean, Vubi is an installer. So, of course, you know, if the program being installed, the OS being installed in this case, is not good, you know, the installer by itself doesn't have legs. So
Ubuntu is pretty
just
good.
As Ubuntu. Yeah, yeah, of course.
It does a pretty good job. Are you still using Debian, or have you moved to Ubuntu now for everything?
I really moved to Ubuntu. It's just basically it is like Debian, so I have all the convenience of Debian. Just I don't have to spend as much time to configure it, so
right.
I can just get down and work on the things I'm interested in without spending too much time tweaking the system. And underneath is really Debian, so everything I loved in Debian is there. So Debian is a great system because it's fully modular. So it means you know, anything you don't like, you can change. It doesn't impose anything on you, and you can take a given distribution and make it anything you like, from a router to a super server. The sky the limit. And you can still do that in Ubuntu, except that if you just want a desktop, you get the desktop out of the box,
right,
and it works out of the box,
right,
without having to waste a few hours configuring and tweaking things.
You got your mom using Vubi?
Actually, yes. Well, not Vubi, because I have Ubuntu installed for real, on a real partition myself. But yes, she does use Ubuntu.
Now that's eating your own dog food. When you have to take tech calls from your mother, you know it better work, right?
Clearly.
Yeah, no, but what I did for them, I created a modified desktop, which is simplified.
Oh, that's
they mostly
good.
Need two or three things. And now they like it so much better. So they, when they go, my brother actually still uses Windows. I didn't manage to convince him. But when they go to his place, they don't like that. And I say, you know, I like the other computer better. So, yeah, cool. So I have this small desktop with just two or three applications you can launch, a browser with the news, card games, email, whatever they need. So it makes it really easy for them.
Well, I really appreciate your time, Agostino, and I almost as much as I appreciate what you've done with Vubi.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day.
All right, you too. Agostino Russo from London, talking about... Now we know, Randall.
Yes.
Vubi,
I know. And Agostino Russo doesn't sound like he's originally from London.
He might be from... I looked on his Facebook page, and there are mostly Italians there, so...
I suspect,
but you know, last week he was our Spanish guy was in Ireland, so that's the thing. We're in a global environment nowadays. You can live and work anywhere, especially if you're in open source.
Yes, it's amazing. When I'm coordinating the show, I have to remember now what time zone is this guy going to be in.
Yeah, we stayed up late to be here with us, so that's nice.
We actually had a comment in the chat room a couple of shows ago. It's like you know, Floss Weekly's become like the most international of all your shows.
It's true.
Because
it's
open source
really
knows no boundaries. The fact that we can pass it freely from one country to another to solve other countries' problems, this is just great. So,
open source, write that. Somebody write that. Twitter it. Open source knows no boundaries.
There we go. Incredible, yeah.
So, Randall, how did the surgery go?
It went very well.
I know we're not supposed to talk about your arm, but, you know, I got to know.
There's this urge of stuff. I mean, I have to say thank you all the people who followed me on Twitter, twitter.com/Merlin with a Y, for following me on Twitter, because I got to do the joke that I talked about last week. The very first Twitter I did coming out of surgery was capital N-O-T, capital D-E-D. So just to let people I hadn't died.
Not dead yet.
Yes. with it about as short as I could possibly get it. But I've let people know that we're following along. And of course, if you're watching this live, you know, I'm just still in the same week of the surgery. By the time you hear this, it'll hopefully have been another week and a half later. And hopefully I'll have been started most of my therapy. I went in to take the post-surgery wraps off, and I'm now in a brace that I'll probably have to wear off and on for the next 6 weeks while my muscles are strengthening back up. The good news is that on the first test, I actually had the same ability to move that I had just before the surgery. So hopefully from here forward with that plate out, I'll be able to get most, if not all, of my flexibility back. And we don't have to talk about this for another 10 or 12 shows at least. That's probably plenty. If you want to know details, please follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Merlin, and I will keep you up to date with way more than you need to know. In fact, some of the Twitter people that were on, let's see, as we're taping this, were on yesterday, got to actually see pictures of my actual... how do you say it? Not scar. It's the sutures. I know. Because I tweeted it right in the opera room there. It was funny.
I know, right? Did you twit picked it? Oh, my God.
I twit picked it, yeah. Oh, so there are some. I did label them, not for the squeamish. So, but hopefully, another 6 to 10 weeks, I will be back to two arm Randall. But for right now, I'm typing with only one hand, and I tell you, it's a lot of work.
Do you have you need text expander or something? You need a little.
I have it for some things. I already have it set up. Like I have an abbreviation for brief. I type =brief, and it says, "Please, I'm typing this one hand. Excuse me for being really brief." And even this was expanded with a macro. I say, "Wait, sorry for being brief, but I'm still typing one handed since I'm recovering from surgery on 19 March." In fact, even this text was inserted with a macro expansion, smiley face. So I have that as one of my expansions.
Yeah, good, good.
Yes.
Who's coming up on this? I'm really glad we got to talk to Agostino. It would have been sad if we had not gotten that on. That was great.
Great show. Great show. Glad he made time in his busy schedule. And I think he went out and bought a special USB headset just so we could talk to him. So that's really nice. Because it sounds so much better when people do that.
It does.
Sometimes. I've gotten mail feedback from time to time when a few of our guests in the last 6 months have not had like really good audio setups and whatever. Anyway, we try to do the best we can. I try to make sure everybody has what they need to have to sound the best. Coming up next week, I have been really looking forward to this show. Jono Bacon, the Ubuntu community manager. Yes, we'll have bacon on the show. We'll have actual bacon on the show.
We're going to baconize the show.
You better have bacon sizzling in the background while
Floss
we do this.
Floss
with bacon. And I tell you, one of the things that Jono Bacon does besides have this the role of being the Ubuntu community manager is he also spends a lot of time going around to conferences. I saw him at Scale, which is why I wanted to bring him on this show when I saw what a powerful speaker he was about creating community and the essential things. And he also has an O'Reilly book coming up on building community, so you'll probably pitch that at least once or twice.
Well, he should know, I'll tell you.
Yeah. He's also a accomplished metal musician, and he had his own band for a while. I don't know if he's still doing it, but I think he's recording songs and putting them on his website, so we'll have him talk about that. But also, he has a podcast called Lug Radio, the Linux Users Group radio show.
And that's actually a very good show.
Oh, I tell you, they stopped producing them middle of last year, but I listened to a couple of episodes already. And I tell you, if he's even half as funny on this show as he was on Lug Radio, this is going to be one rip-roaring show. You're not going to want to miss this one coming up because that's just going to be a heck of a deal. So I'm really looking forward to that. Continuing on, I have a few more shows coming up after that. I have Stefan Reinauer of Coreboot, which is an open source replacement for BIOS. So instead of running the standard stock BIOS that comes with the system, you can reflash it and have a completely open source solution all the way down to the actual hardware. And it works on over 200 hardware kind of systems and stuff. That's going to be an interesting show. I want to talk a lot about how the hardware is interfaced and how they manage all the different types of physical machines out there. So it's going to be a fun show. After that, we've got some guys from the Cinelera project, which is the open source video editing suite that got mentioned a few weeks ago when Aaron Newcomb was on. We're also going to have Christopher Hall from the Open Moco project, which is the open source phone, sort of the third leg.
I have an Open Moco device.
You do?
It's my Dash GPS.
Oh, it runs there, too.
It runs an OpenMoco, yeah.
Wow, that's very cool. And a news flash from last week, between last week and now, I've been approached by the handlers for Ian Pratt, of the Zen project, which is the big virtualization project that lets you run arbitrary operating systems as guests within other arbitrary operating systems as hosts. It's the technology behind real large things like Amazon EC2 and people having giant racks of machines that you can rent partial time on and things like that. I hear even Google's using it behind the scenes for a lot of their equipment allocation stuff. So that's really excited about that. It's going to be sometime probably in either late April or early May for that show, but we'll get them on as well. And so a bunch of other people on the short list. Again, if you want to know who's coming up soon, go to twit.tv/floss. There's a link there to my spreadsheet that I keep up to date daily about people I'm looking at, people I'm already talking to, and so on. And you'll see the list of now 150 names beyond that I'm still trying to figure out what order to put them in and that sort of stuff. So I mean, it's just been great. Like I said, I think we said this last week, but we could do Floss daily, and I wouldn't out of people for like 30 or 40 weeks. So
yeah, we've got to figure this out. Yeah.
Oh, Leo, that was a good show. I love this. It's great. Wubby, great thing. It's something I would never use. In fact, I was chatting earlier today that I have never owned a machine that was licensed for Windows as purchased. I must be the only geek in the world for whom that qualifies.
Wait a minute, let me hear this again. You've never owned a machine that was licensed for Windows?
Yes, ever.
You mean you never bought a computer that had Windows pre-installed?
No. Ever, never, I've stayed with the Mac side. I went to the Mac 68040s and then the PPCs.
I've owned many a Windows machine.
Yeah. So I've never had a Windows license legally ever in my life. Like I said, it's why people, you know, as I was preparing for this week's show, I was Twittering that I don't have anything I can play with this on. People were suggesting all sorts of things that weren't exactly legal. And I said, no, I can't do that. So
Colleen has told me Wubby is wonderful. Everybody loves it. I've never used it either. But not because I just install Ubuntu, you know.
Yeah,
I'm a little, I guess, past the Wubby time, but I should try it just to see, because I have recommended it on the radio show many times.
I know this seems like a really great thing. And it's anything to get people to be able to try Ubuntu and other Floss software, kind of Ubuntu being the gateway drug to the rest of the open source software. Anything to get that is fine by me. This is great that this is happening. And I'm really glad that there are projects like this to make it one step easier. So I have to do that really scary repartitioning and stuff when I don't know if I want to do it or not. So really good. A great show. I had a good time talking with Agostino. That was perfect.
Well, that's great. That's great. Mm-hmm. A lot of fun. Randall mm-hmm. Schwartz, you are great. You could find Randall, as he said on Twitter, but he says Merlin. Now, I got to tell you, that's Merlyn,
mm-hmm.
not I-N. Mm-hmm. Not like the magician, like the other magician.
And not like Merlin Mann. That's the other. That's what I'm
not like Merlin Mann either.
Nope.
And who also doesn't have Merlin. But anyway, that's another. He's hot dogs, ladies of all things.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know.
That just shows you how famous he doesn't want to be. and you can also reach him at stonehenge.com or email him there. And we will see you. Do you know who you got? Who's next week? Did you mention it? You did.
I don't know if I bet you.
Jono.
Bacon.
Jono.
Now, remember, you wanted me to warn you. Rockstar.
Yeah,
rockstar.
No. I remember. Rockstar.
Okay.
Funny. Rockstar. Bacon. Jono. Ubuntu community. I got it.
Come listen.
We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.